Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Flint, Michigan, and became a baseball pitcher. He won the James E. Sullivan Award as our nation's best amateur athlete in 1987. He won a gold medal in the 1988 Summer Olympics and pitched the final game. He pitched in the major leagues for 10 years and threw a no-hitter for the Yankees in 1993. Oh, by the way, he was born without a right hand. His name? Jim Abbott. And I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to the baseball player with one hand, our own Jim Abbott. Jim, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Can we start by talking about your parents and your childhood?
Well, I guess the name of the show is Anything Is Possible, and I think that's the spirit with which I was raised. You know, I feel like I just had tremendous parents, not in that they were any more or any less than any other parents. I just think they had a tremendous, why not attitude. And I was born a little bit different, born missing my right hand, and there was nothing that they shielded me away from. They were believers in experience and getting involved, seeing what you can do, and I'm just tremendously thankful and blessed to have had a mom and dad like I did, and there aren't many days that I don't think about the blessing that I had as having them as parents and try to pass some of their lessons down to my own children.
On September 19th, you turned 40. When your parents had you, how old were they?
They were relatively young, just in their college age years.
What did you learn from your mom, and what did you learn from your dad?
Well, I learned from my mom an incredible dedication. She is a very disciplined, kind and hardworking person, very principled. She's an attorney now. She wasn't, obviously, when I was born. She was very young. She raised two boys and then went back to law school later on while we were growing up. And many nights I went to sleep hearing her typewriter rattling away, and back when they still had typewriters. And, woke up in the morning and she was still tapping away. And she got her degree, she passed the bar, she went to work, and ever since then she's just done really well, a hardworking person, very dedicated, very principled, and I think I've learned a lot from her just by watching her example in that way. And my dad is a fun-loving guy, very empathetic and understanding person, a good listener, able to put himself in other people's shoes, and somebody who just wants to extract every moment that he can out of life. And I've learned an appreciation for experiences, I think, through him.
You have a brother?
I have a younger brother, yes.
And he's a terrific soccer player.
He was, yeah. He was a good athlete coming out of Flint. You have to play sports growing up in Flint. And my brother played soccer and baseball, and we're close to this day. He's getting married in the fall, family's looking forward to heading up and getting together for that.
How do you explain that he, with two good arms, played soccer where you don't use your arms, and you, with one great arm, played baseball where you need both arms, and not soccer?
Well, I think my parents were like that. My brother played baseball, too, and loved baseball. But I think you follow your passion. I think my parents encouraged us to find things that we love to do, and believe that when you find something you love to do, you practice it, and you get better at it. I think that attitude, you know, allowed my brother and I to become very different people, although we grew up under the same house and have a lot of the same beliefs and common interests. We are very different, and you know, I'm not so sure that I'm a big soccer fan. And I teased him a lot about that growing up, but he was good at it. He was fast and quick, and where I was a little bit more slow and methodical, so maybe there's a more common sense reason for it.
How did you first get into sports, Jim?
Oh, I got into sports just because that's what kids in Flint did. My peer group was the kids I grew up with, even all the way back to elementary school. The kids I liked and looked up to were athletes and people who played sports on the playground. And as soon as recess bell hit, you know, we were out there playing. Looking back on it, I don't think I knew at the time, but looking back on it, I think sports played a big part in wanting to fit in. You know, my hand always was there. It was always a presence in my life. And it gave me an ambition to fit in, to be a part of something, to be on a team. And if I was good enough to do that at recess or in the schoolyard, you know, I could gain a lot of acceptance in the classroom and in the rest of my life. And I'm not saying that it was a conscious effort, but I do believe that that was a part of growing up and, you know, who I was and why I played sports.
At every level, whether it was a little league, Babe Ruth League, high school, college, major leagues, every coach, when you said, I'm going to pitch, had to say, no way, Jose. How did you handle all of those naysayers?
Well, Jack, it was even. you know, there were naysayers. There were those people who said, it can't be done. But for the most part, I was incredibly lucky. I grew up in Flint, which was a great town. I know it's a tough town. I know the reputation that it has in some places. But there are wonderful people there. And there's wonderful people who took time out of their day when I was growing up to encourage me, to help me to find the ways that it would take for me to play pitcher, for me to play basketball, for me to play football and quarterback. And for every one naysayer that there might have been, there were five more people who were in my corner, who took the time, who went so far above and beyond what was, you know, needed, asked for, or even appropriate, that it's amazing to me, the generosity, the very generous spirit that I was surrounded with growing up. And I think, you know, I benefited greatly from these people.
When we come back, we'll ask Jim Abbott about the constant razzing that he must have gotten in his youth. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're with Jim Abbott, who won the James E. Sullivan Award as our nation's best amateur athlete in 1987. What a thrill, what a thrill. Jim, when a kid is different, the other kids in the neighborhood razz him unmercifully. So you had a lot of that. What advice would you give to such people who are different?
Well, first of all, I think you have to acknowledge it. I do think that is one of the most difficult hurdles to get over, is being different. For me, it wasn't the physical adaptations that were necessary. It was more the mental. And it's day in and it's day out and it's consistent. So I try to talk to kids, and I talk to kids all over the country to this very day. I get many calls and letters from parents and children with all kinds of challenges, and I just encourage them to find what it is that they love to do and stay very strong and determined and aware of the messages that can change that opinion and that goal that they have for themselves. And it's hard. It is very hard. It takes a lot of strength. It takes a lot of awareness. Whether you're physically different or whether you're physically like everybody else, I think that we need to be very strong and diligent to look out for the negativity that can seep in to our consciousness and change how we feel about ourselves. And it's not an easy answer. There's no magic formula for it, but that's what it takes. And I think because of my experiences in playing the game and having the naysayers and having the positive experiences, that when I do talk to kids, that they understand it, that I understand it. It's not easy. It takes incredible amount of awareness and strength to do it. And, they can do it, though. Anything is possible, like you say. It's much more difficult than any physical work that they have to do. It's the mental discipline involved.
A pitcher's mound is 60 feet 6 inches from home plate. So you throw the ball with your left hand. You have to somehow get the glove then on the left hand. If the ball comes back at you, you have to catch it, somehow get that ball out of that glove, okay, and get it over to first base. How did you ever learn to do that?
Well, I duck most of the time. That if it was too fast. But, I just learned to throw and catch with my left hand. I used to switch the glove on and off pretty quickly, and I used to practice that over and over again when I was a kid. I loved sports. I was a little bit of a dreamer when I was a kid. I used to shoot a lot of baskets by myself, and I used to throw a lot of baseballs up against a brick wall, just imagining that I was Jack Morris or Nolan Ryan or somebody throwing pitches against that wall. And it was a little game that I would play. I would just move closer and closer to the wall, and I would try to get to a point where I could throw the ball and have the glove back on in time to catch it before it hit the ground. And that did a great deal to help me learn how to switch the glove on and off. And then I had a great coach in the major leagues, a man named Jimmy Reese, who was in his 80s. And we used to work on fielding all the time. He had this old fungo bat. It was a Reggie Jackson bat that Reggie had given him, and he sawed it in half, and he just hit fungos to pitchers over and over again. Jimmy used to hit me one ball after another, and I practiced the rhythm of it and the flow of delivering a pitch and having that glove back on. And, you know, nobody's perfect. If it's hit hard enough, it's going to get by you. But I felt like I held my own and fielded my position pretty well in the major leagues.
How did you ever get to the University of Michigan? And talk about your career with the Wolverines.
Well, I was a longtime Michigan fan. I grew up a Michigan football fan. I grew up a University of Michigan fan. And I was doing well enough in high school where my ability was being noticed by, you know, college scouts in the area and professional scouts here and there. And once Bud Middaugh, my coach at Michigan, came into the picture and offered me an opportunity to visit the university, and I had a great coach by the name of Ted Mahan, who was my summer league coach, and he had played catcher at Michigan in the early 70s with Rick Leach and Steve Howe and those great players down there. Once that Michigan entered the picture and Coach Middaugh offered me a scholarship, I was sold, and I was ready to go. It was a long-time dream come true for me.
You won the James E. Sullivan Award as our nation's best amateur athlete in 87. What was that experience like?
Well, it was an amazing experience. I was at school. I had played a couple years at Michigan and done pretty well, and then I was asked to play on the Pan American team, which meant you played in the Pan Am games that they just had recently here this summer. But that year they were held in Indianapolis, and I was asked to play on the United States team and pitched pretty well throughout the summer and got some attention there. And then in the fall of that year, I was asked to go to this big Sullivan Award banquet down in Indianapolis again. It was a beautiful event, black tie affair. My mom and dad went with me, and a lot of the great amateur athletes in the country were there. Janet Evans, the swimmer, and David Robinson, the basketball player, Karch Karai from volleyball. An amazing group of athletes. And To be very, very honest, and I had no inclination or even wildest dream that I might be even in the running for the thing. And I was sitting at the dais, and Jackie Joyner Kersee announced the winner, and she said Jim Abbott. And I about fell off my chair. A baseball player had never won it, and to this day, I think there's a lot of people who probably wonder what in the heck I was doing. But hey, it was a tremendous honor. I was floored by it, and really have come to appreciate the significance of it as I've gotten older.
You were the first pitcher, American pitcher, in 25 years to beat a Cuban baseball team on Cuban soil. Talk to us about that.
Well, that was, pretty exciting. You know, we were playing in Cuba against, that was the Pan Am team in 1987, that same year of the Sullivan Award, and part of the lead-up to the Pan Am Games was our trip down to Cuba. We were the first team to play there in 25 years representing the United States, and it was a very hyped affair. A lot of media was there. To the Cubans, it was an extremely big deal. They made quite a deal of our team coming down there. There were 50,000 people at every game, five-game series, and it turned out that I was scheduled to pitch the third game of the series, and we lost the first couple. The Cubans were celebrating, taking a lot of pride in the fact that they had whipped us pretty good, and Fidel Castro came to the games, and it was a wild scene. And eventually, I ended up pitching that third game, and we won. We beat the Cubans, and tremendous honor. It was, a real validation for the kids in our team, because we were playing a Cuban team that was much older, and widely regarded as the best amateur team in the world at the time. So, to beat them and gave us an incredible amount of confidence going into the Pan Am Games and then eventually into the Olympics the following year.
We're talking to Jim Abbott. When we come back, we'll ask him about the 88 Summer Olympics. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Jim Abbott, who pitched the final game for America in the 1988 Summer Olympics. Jim, can you share us that phenomenal experience?
Well, that was one of the great experiences of my life, and probably the greatest team experience of my whole life, just because, we talked a little bit earlier about the 1987 Pan Am team. We were a group of college sophomores that had been picked by the United States Baseball Federation to play together, and it was a bit of a gamble by USA Baseball, because they took the chance that this group of sophomores would be able to finish in the top three at the Pan Am Games and therefore earn a berth the following year in the Olympics. And by assembling mostly sophomores, they pretty much picked the team for the following year, which would be a group of juniors the next year, and all the more better. It worked out pretty well. We basically had the same core of guys the following year in Seoul, Korea. Tremendous group of friends and baseball players, Robin Ventura from Oklahoma State, and Tino Martinez, and Charles Nagy, and a lot of good friends to this day. And we just really gelled as a team, and we, although we had great players, we were probably better together than we were as just an assembly of individuals. And we played together for the whole next summer, finally culminating in that gold medal game. We had just built up for that one purpose. That's all we thought about, all we talked about. We used to debate who would be the one pitching. And I did get the chance to pitch that game, and pitched a complete game, 9 innings, and we won 5-3 over Japan. And I'll never forget the jam pile celebration with that group of friends and that team. It was really such a validation and such a culmination for a long time spent together in one singular purpose, to win the gold medal for the United States.
We're talking to Jim Abbott. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Jim Abbott, who pitched the final game in 1988 for America. Complete game to win the gold medal against Japan. Jim, what was it like when you were standing on that podium, you received the gold medal, and we play the national anthem?
It was an indescribable feeling. It was, you never imagine yourself, you do imagine yourself there, and yet at the same time, when you're there, you say, you can't believe this ever happened. And to represent the United States, and again, to win it as a team was very special. Not only was it such a dream come true, but it was a shared experience. And I think it multiplied the enjoyment many times. I just, you know, just one of the happiest times of my life. And, you know, look back on that with extreme fondness and pride. And to hear the national anthem and to represent your country and to think about having played in Japan and Cuba and a few other places where I was told that kids with disabilities and missing hands aren't always given the same opportunities that maybe we have here in the United States. You know, I'm very proud of where I came from, Flint, Michigan, and all that entails.
Hayes Jones was a guest. He's a good friend. Grew up in Pontiac, the high hurdles. For 5.5 years, he didn't lose a race for 5.5 years straight. And he wins a gold medal in 64. And he says, to this day, whenever he watches the Olympics, Jim, and an American wins the gold medal, gets up on the stand, and they play the national anthem, he rises, and he reenacts that moment. What do you do when you see that over and over?
Well, I definitely am at times transported back to that moment. I love watching the Olympics. I love the intense national pride that comes about, it's an emotional event. It is something that you feel a part of, to be an Olympian alumnus and to share those stories. And you know, not every person who gets up there, but a lot of them, I do. You know, there is a little twinge that you get, a little tingle up your spine that you understand that feeling, and they're going to be asked about that for the rest of their lives. What's it like to stand there? And they're going to stumble and mumble and not being able to describe it like everybody else, because it is just such an amazing, amazing and rare accomplishment.
Where is your medal?
It's at home. It's I live in California most of the time, although I'm up in northern Michigan in the summertime. And I keep it there, and I bring it out occasionally when I go to visit kids at schools or maybe my daughter's classes. And, it's been dropped a couple times. And but, you know, I like it all the more for that, to be able to share it.
For show and tell, it must be a pretty big highlight, huh?
So. Well, you think it is, and then, you know, they drop it on the ground and move on to the next thing. So at least you get to enjoy it.
1988, you're the first round pick of the California Angels. You're the 8th pick of that draft. How much time did you spend in the minor leagues?
Well, initially, I did a little backwards. Initially, I went to the major leagues directly from amateur baseball. And it sounds a little bit grander than it was. What happened with the Olympics was in the fall of that year in September, and then took the winter off and went to spring training the following year with the Angels, and I made the team and ended up skipping the minor leagues entirely. Unfortunately, at the end of my career, I had to go back for a little bit. But, I went directly to the major leagues, went from, you know, that exciting amateur baseball moment of playing with those guys and all over the country to all of a sudden playing against guys I'd only seen on TV, Alan Trammell and Jack Morris and the Tigers. I'll never forget being in the outfield in Anaheim Stadium when we played the Tigers for the first time, and Jack Morris walked up to me. He had a warm-up jacket on. He looked at me, and he said, "You made it, kid." And I kind of smiled, and he said, "The trick is to stay." And he was right. He was right. The trick is to stay.
One night in 1993, all the stars were aligned, and you pitch a no-hitter in Yankee Stadium for the Yankees. Tell us about that.
Well, that was another special time. You know, No-hitters are kind of crazy in that they come so far out of the blue, and you don't really expect them. You prepare yourself like every other game. You know, you're working towards something. It's really the last thing on your mind. And suddenly, in the sixth inning or so, you notice that the circumstances are changing, and particularly there in Yankee Stadium, where history feels like it's seeped into every nook and cranny, and the fans are so great and so involved that when something like that starts happening, a no-hitter or something that they're caught up in, the atmosphere immediately changes, and you just feel it in your bones, and they start cheering wildly with every strike that you throw and booing the umpire every time that he calls a ball. And you know, it was a very pitched atmosphere, very exciting. The Indians were a good ball club at the time, good hitting club. And, you know, to do it, to have it go from, you know, that sort of workmanlike game to a dream being right in front of you, and to keep working through that anxiousness and that anxiety and each pitch at a time, and then going back and sitting in the dugout and having to wait to go out there again and get three more outs, and then come back in the dugout and get three more outs again, and finally to have it culminate there in the ninth inning. And you know, when you got goosebumps, your spine is tingling, your heart's racing, and you just try to trust your pitch and throw it as best you can, and it works. And you get that final out, and it's another indescribable joy.
For most of your career, you were in the American League, which has the designated hitter. Did you ever bat in the major leagues with one arm?
Well, I have, you know, I use both of my arms when I hit. And most everything I do, I tried to incorporate both arms. I felt like I was more balanced that way. But I did hit. I hit in the major leagues in spring training often. And then at the end of my career, I finished up with the Milwaukee Brewers, and I got to hit for half a season. I got two hits, both against the Cubs, which I'll bring up. One was in Wrigley Field, which was exciting. I don't know if I was a great hitter, but I felt like I held my own. I could bunt and do what was necessary. So I will say that hitting is one of the most difficult things athletically, if not the most difficult thing that I can imagine, especially at the major league level. Those pitchers are so good. Your reaction time is so quick that it's hard to fathom that guys can be as good as they are.
What did baseball teach you about life?
Baseball taught me a lot of important lessons about life, and one is that it's very uneven, and it's constantly changing and constantly testing you. At least my experience was that way for me playing. And it's always asking you, what did you learn? How can you improve? What can you do day in and day out to be better tomorrow, to get ready for that next game, for that next challenge, for that next lineup? And baseball is a game that forces you to change. It forces you to adapt and get better and work hard consistently. And that's just one of the many lessons the game taught me, but probably the most important.
We're talking to Jim Abbott, and he's living proof that disability does not have to mean inability. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Jim Abbott, who has a book, Nothing to Prove, The Jim Abbott Story. Jim, who's the best you ever saw play?
The best player I ever played against, well, when I early in my career, I was in awe of George Brett, and I couldn't get him out to save my life. Great player. And Ricky Henderson was an amazingly good baseball player, fast, with power. He changed the game, you know, incredibly. He didn't have to hit the ball. He could get a walk. He'd steal second, steal third. Tremendously difficult player to pitch against. Unfortunately, some of the guys from the steroid era, you know, were you know, very tough to get out. A lot of home runs but in terms of professionalism and guys that I admired, Alan Trammell was right there at the top of the list. Don Mattingly, two of the guys I admired the most in the game.
What do you do today, Jim?
Well, I am very lucky. Baseball has given me a tremendous amount of opportunities. I get to spend some time with the Angels. Like I said, I live in Southern California and have a great affiliation with the Angel team. I go to spring training and spend some time with them, and Mike Socia and his staff, and root for their success quite a bit. I have two daughters now, and I spend a lot of time with them, raising them, being a part of their lives, coaching fast-pitch softball, which is an amazing challenge to figure out that pitching motion. And above and beyond that, I'm involved in various projects. Probably the most significant is doing some motivational speaking around the country, which has been exciting. It kind of started very very small and has grown into something that has become quite popular. I mean, traveling around and meeting a lot of great people, a lot of great careers that they're involved in, and having a chance to share my story and some of the lessons that I took from the game and pass them on. And it's amazing to me the similarities of challenges that we all face, no matter what, activities we're involved in.
What's the basic message you try to get across in these speeches?
Well, I try to be a voice like you, Jack. I try to be a voice for what is possible. I believe that good things can happen. We talked a little bit earlier about some of the negativity and pessimism, cynicism that we face out there. And I just try to open up people's eyes, maybe in a little bit different way, to what can happen. And the idea that you don't have to be defined by the circumstances of your life. You can change the story of your life. You can be what you want to be. And I use my story and anecdotal evidence from my career, both from growing up in Michigan to the major leagues, and try to support that and get people to see, maybe not only in their work life, but, in their personal life, of what good things can happen, and just be a positive voice out there.
You've said, Jim, that the challenge for you as a professional speaker has been to try and formulate a common language, and the word that you've come up with is adapt. Explain that to us.
Well, it is, and I'm amazed by, like I said before, that we all are involved in different endeavors in life. What some person might do, a group that I may go speak to, may be completely different than what I did as a baseball player. But it seems to me that certain principles move beyond these boundaries, and that we all sort of follow these same ideas and try to apply them just to different activities. So I thought about that a lot, and I thought about what was important to me, the lessons my dad taught me from playing, and I talk about adapt, just being able to grow and evolve and change yourself to what you want to be. And I broke that down into an acronym, ADAPT, the first letter being adjustability. And that, to me, is the willingness to do things in a different way. I use switching the glove on and off as an idea of finding something you love and finding a different way to do it, taking a chance. Determination, D, is the second letter, and that's about the strength and awareness to filter out that negativity and pessimism and the daily creeping negatives, as Lance Armstrong described them, and change those into a positive message that we think in the way we think of ourselves. The middle letter of adapt is accountability. It's about the obligation we have to the abilities that we've been given, no matter what they are, large or small. For me, concentrating on what was given in my left hand, forgetting about what was not given to me in my right. The fourth letter is perseverance. You've been kind enough to bring out a lot of the highlights of my career. There were also a lot of struggles and a fight for my job in the big leagues, and some difficult lessons, and I use those to illustrate the importance of perseverance and sticking with it. And finally, trust, T, comes at the end. And for me, that's knowing what your strengths are, knowing what it is that makes you great, what you love, and And when you need your best performance, when you need to come through, you know, identifying those strengths, being aware of them, and being able to apply them without fear and without hesitation, and which was an incredibly important lesson in my major league career. And I talk about the no-hitter and sort of the lessons of that, and the anxiety and the tension and all that that was going on, and trying to refocus all of that down to what it is I did best. And trust, you know, it's just a great concept and seems to have a lot of relevance in other people's lives. So ADAPT has been great. It's been a great common language. People have responded to it. I've got a lot of great feedback. And, it's not five steps to better living or anything like that. I'm not going to have anybody walking on hot coals at the end of the thing, but it is about baseball, and I think a lot of people love baseball. A lot of people love stories that aren't necessarily a parade down Main Street. There's struggle, there's disappointment, there's victory, and it's been nice. I've appreciated the opportunity to share it.
Let's go back September 19th, 1967. If God came to you today and said, well, let's go back to that day, and Jim, if you want, I'll give you two healthy, full-developed hands. What would you say to God?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, if I could just frame it a little bit differently, I'll just say that my youngest daughter asked me one time if I liked my little hand. And I told her that I did. You know, it was a tough question, and I wanted to be honest with her. I like the experiences that I've had. They haven't always been easy. You know, I certainly have struggled with being different. But I like what it has taught me and the appreciation it's given me for other people and their struggle and the idea that life isn't always easy, but good things can happen.
Who are your heroes, Jim Abbott?
My heroes?
Yes.
My heroes are people like my parents, people like the coaches that I had growing up, people who have their house in order enough to where they're there for other people to give opportunities, to reach out, to help. Those are the people that inspire me.
We have 1 minute left. Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, I think I would use the old cliche to believe in yourself. And our listeners hear that, and young people hear that over and over again. But I believe that it's incredibly important to, no matter what's going on around you, the most difficult of circumstances or changing times or challenging times, to understand what it is that makes you great, what makes you special, and to believe in those talents and those abilities, and never, ever let somebody else's opinion change how you feel about yourself. Constantly reinforce the positive attributes that you have. And then when time comes, when you need your best performance, it's very easily drawn up and very accessible.
Jim Abbott, it's been an honor to have you. What an inspiration you've been and continue to be to millions of people all over the world. Thanks for being with us.
It's my honor, Jack, and congratulations on the show, and it's good work that you do. Good luck.
Thank you. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.